ordinance number 11-SA-51, Smith versus Jeppesen with an intervener, State Farm. Both parties?
All set.
We're all set, Your Honor.
Argument set for 30 minutes, 15 minutes aside, and it's really not the appellant, but the state your name.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, and counsel for State Farm. My name's Frank Patterson. I represent the petitioner Michael Jeppesen, who is a defendant in the trial court below. And this is a Rule 21 petition. Mr. Seaman represents State Farm. I'll try to reserve a few minutes for him to speak on behalf of State Farm as well. The court's heard several hours of arguments on similar issues here, and I won't try to repeat that. But let me start first by saying that I listened again last night to some of the recordings from April of 2010 when this court considered Garden Swartz and this case on its first Rule 21 petition. And several of the justices were dealing with the difficult issue of collateral source. Is this a benefit? Starting with the billed versus paid, the amount billed and then the amount paid, is there a benefit? And you asked questions, I think, Justice Coates and Justice Ide and I forget who else asked, but several of you were dealing with the difficult issue of whether the collateral source doctrine is even engaged or triggered. And the defense counsel in that case just conceded it. It simply conceded that, well, it's some kind of benefit. We're not quite sure because there's no money changing hands, but we treat it like a benefit. Well, since then, we've had the benefit of the Howell versus Hamilton Meats case in California. And I propose the rhetorical question, don't we think that they got it right in California? That, in fact, that it is not a triggering of the collateral source rule when there's a billed versus paid. If we use the example of a bill of $100,000 from the hospital and the amount that's paid is $25,000, which happens regularly, that piece of paper, that bill that says $100,000 is in fact a nullity. It doesn't really exist in the real world. And in California, they concluded
that except when you get rebilled for it. I mean, the consumer in this society just has a complex situation here where you get a bill from a provider, you get, you know, an inscrutable insurance adjustment of some sort, and then you get it turned over to a collection agency to collect on the original bill.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Colorado law.
Tell me why that isn't so.
Colorado law precludes that from happening. Balance billing is simply not permitted.
Okay.
If the insurance or if the provider has agreed before any treatment's provided that this is the value we will charge for that service, they are required to accept that. So in the instance of the plaintiff in this case, at the moment he was injured, at the moment he received treatment, the value of the service that should have been billed was $25,000. The fact that the hospital may have sent out a piece of paper that said $100,000 is irrelevant. Because as California found, what they had agreed to before the incident even occurred was that the hospital would only charge $25,000.
Is this some kind of consumer fraud the hospital is perpetrating then?
No, it's
to get people to overpay?
Well,
I mean, I don't quite understand it.
Yeah, hopefully no one ever overpays. As we've seen from the research that's been provided with the briefs, the hospitals may have other ulterior motives for putting large numbers on a piece of paper that they know means nothing to this consumer. And that bill doesn't go to the consumer. The bill goes to the health insurer, who then pays the agreed upon amount. So my argument is that I agree with California, which is that maybe we revisit the thinking in Garden Swartz that there never was a collateral source that was being triggered. There never was a benefit for which that the injured person has collaterally contracted for.
That would appear to be different from the reasoning we've used in our cases. You would like us to correct ourselves?
I think so. Because Garden Swartz and the arguments that occurred in that case and then the opinion itself assumed that the bill for $100,000 was in fact relevant to that person, relevant to the plaintiff in an individual case. And it is not. The logic is that it doesn't mean anything. Before the incident even occurred, the only bill that could have been anticipated was for the amount paid. And if we agree that the amount actually paid by previous agreement is the amount billed, then we don't have to go through all the other mental gymnastics that we do. We don't have to go through the gymnastics of deciding whether it's a benefit that triggered a collateral source. We don't have to go through the gymnastics of deciding whether it's a windfall to one person or another. We don't have to decide if it's phantom damages to somebody.
Putting aside for just a moment your request to ask us to overturn Garden Swartz, how does your argument play in with this definition of benefits under the newly enacted statute 10-1-135, which, as I read it, benefits is described as including a whole host of things, but that list includes other benefits of any kind, including discounts and write-offs.
And my argument starts by saying I think California got it right, but we have the Garden Swartz case that...
And we now have a statute, so I guess I'm just asking you to... How would we get there given this language?
We get back then if the court then has to deal with 10-1-135, especially subsection 10. And I agree with Ms. Salg, who argued just before us on behalf of Walmart with regard to the single subject violation of the Colorado Constitution. Subsection 10 is a completely separate and distinct statute and should have been separate and distinct. So therefore, it violates the single subject and can't be it has to be stricken.
Okay, so, but I guess I'll ask you the same question I asked Ms. Salg, which is, if we disagree with you and we're left with this plain language, do you concede that that would be then dispositive of this issue?
No, I don't concede that.
Okay, then what is your alternative construction?
Okay, I return to what Justice Coates asked, I believe, in follow-up to your question in the last argument, which is, how do we then reconcile the first sentence of that statute that says none of this is meant to modify or change the collateral source, the application of the collateral source rule? If, in fact, that is what it's intended, that it's not to modify it, the following sentence does the exact opposite.
So then, then how do we give any meaning to it at all? I mean, I guess as I understand your argument, it would
just like it.
It's literally meaningless. You would have us read it to be meaningless.
It's an add-on provision to a statute that doesn't fit. It's poorly worded. It conflicts with the rest of it, and it's internally inconsistent. So if it's internally inconsistent, then I think the court. As the public policy finders, has to decide how we make the best out of the bad statute.
It's true, and it
well, you're
to be public policy finders.
You're to construe it in accordance with what you can glean to be the public policy in it, even if it's poorly worded. And then that gets us back to then how do you apply the collateral source to a situation where we have really three levels, and what we've all these cases. Are troublesome because we all recognize, I think, that the amount billed is seldom realistic. The amount paid is significantly less. When all the cases on billed amounts or paid amounts are some evidence of the reasonable value, in that time period, the difference was always much smaller. In the last two decades, that difference has significantly grown. So all along, we've been trying to find that middle ground. What is the reasonable value of the services? And societally, we've changed from where the amount billed is closer to the reasonable value to a situation where the amount paid is actually closer.
Mr. Patterson, what about the argument that both plaintiff's lawyers have made in one fashion or another, that when you do that, you end up with the amount paid sort of counter to what you're saying, that the value is somewhere in between? So what do you say about that?
Why do we fear telling the jury the truth?
You're telling the jury the truth, discounted amount, telegraphs, and it also means, just as both plaintiff's lawyers have said, that people can't recover on the basis of some value for anything that was paid. And particularly, I think, in the southern, well, lots of areas where the discounted amount is grossly under serving what the reasonable value of medical services are, such as the Walmart case, where you have a $240,000 billed and $40,000 paid. And I would suggest that's got to do with, in part, where it happened. And second, the enormous power that the medical the insurance companies have on medical services.
These nationwide hospitals have enormous bargaining power just as well. These are arm's length transactions, and I don't accept that the insurance companies, especially insurance companies that work state by state, have the ability to strong arm a nationwide hospital system. But let me get to a couple of other points you raise. If, in fact, there's a huge disparity like that, 40,000 versus 240,000, that doesn't necessarily tell you that the 40,000 is unfair. It could tell you the 240,000 is simply unreasonable. Right.
Not either one.
But if you look at the research, though, all the research that's been provided to the court and cited in the brief shows that nowadays the amount paid is much closer to reality than the amount billed. Now, I do want to save some time for Mr. Seaman, but I would like to touch on one other point that Justice Bender raised, which is what if the jury finds out? I asked the question, why do we fear telling the jury the truth? Well, we only fear it if it brings in something that the jury would make up its mind on an impermissible basis. Rule, I think it's 408 on insurance, says you can't tell them about liability insurance. Maybe it's 406, but they might make their decision on liability based upon the fact that insurance exists. But we don't have that problem with health insurance. Telling the jury that health insurance has paid the amount that has been reimbursed to the plaintiff doesn't violate a rule of evidence, and we only worry about it if they were to make up their mind on an impermissible basis. But we can instruct them, just as Judge Hoffman did, you are still to find what is the reasonable amount of the medical expenses in this case. And I'll try to reserve the rest for Mr. Seaman.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're in rebuttal. I apologize.
You want me to go next?
He's waiting for 3 minutes for rebuttal. I thought you were.
I didn't know if you wanted to go next or not.
Me neither.
Mr. Chief Justice Bender, Justices of the Colorado Supreme Court, Mr. Patterson, Mr. Seaman, and those in attendance who have written amicus briefs, and I think there's still maybe a few here.
Probably most of the audience.
This has been an interesting discourse this morning, and I think it misses the point in a lot of particulars. Recent statistics are 40% of people in America are insured, and it's going down all the time. So we're talking about who has insurance and the billed amount and the paid amount. What about the other 60% who are uninsured and Medicaid donee recipients of public aid? What happens in all of those cases? And how do we create and carve out a different class of jury instructions vis-a-vis COPIC? And how do we carve out a special rule of evidentiary instructions for this case, because this happens to be a plaintiff who had auto insurance or had health insurance, and this fortuitous defendant over here who had the good luck to hit somebody who had United Healthcare versus having hit some poor person who had Medicaid or who had no insurance, who got billed the full amount? And what about the current situation that exists, which I just got this week, where my client goes to the hospital on an automobile accident taken to St. Anthony Central, and the billed amount, the bill comes for the full amount. My client already got the bill. So what do? I had the stupidity to order medical records. That triggers a response over at the hospital. Guess what got filed within 7 days? A statutory lien with the Colorado Secretary of State's office. They refused, St. Anthony's refused to bill Medicare, which my client is on, Instead, they are demanding the full amount of the bill under the hospital lien statute. And this goes on regularly. Here's where we really are. The measure of the reasonable value of medical services is the issue. That ought to be central to all cases. Doesn't matter if you have health insurance, doesn't matter if you have Medicaid, doesn't matter if you have Medicare, doesn't matter if you're uninsured. It's the reasonable value of the medical services. It's been that forever. Is this going to cause all this additional cost to bring in all of these experts? No. What have you been doing for the last 40 years? We've been doing this all along. It hasn't added an additional cost. It's not going to add an additional cost. It's still a matter of proof. The plaintiff puts on their evidence. The defendant counters the evidence. It's not going to be any different. The prevailing market rate is the big question. Okay, what is it? Okay, this was the billed amount. Is that reasonable? Is that unreasonable? You have testimony that it is. You have countervailing testimony that it isn't. The measure should be the same.
Could I stop you right there, Mr. Thomason? Just one question?
Yes.
If we're talking about the reasonable market rate, you seem to be taking the position that the amount billed, though, is some evidence of the reasonable market rate, but not the amount paid.
Absolutely.
And how is that?
Well, because of this, Your Honor. It doesn't matter if I'm insured, underinsured, or Medicaid, I get the same bill. So it just so happens that I'm uninsured, and Mr. Rodman's statement was that only 5% of those get paid. It's because they're broke, they declare medical bankruptcy, they discharge them. And so the only way we ever get to the paid amount is I happen to have United Healthcare insurance over here. And so all of a sudden United Healthcare pays some rate different than Aetna, some rate different than Blue Cross Blue Shield, some rate different than Cigna. It's all different.
But so, I take it when you're willing to allow that what we're interested in is a reasonable market rate and evidence can come in about market conditions.
Right.
Doesn't that seem to imply that the amount billed is not related or not directly related to the reasonable value, but rather the reasonable value requires some determination from the existing market conditions?
And I agree. It does require some determination about the reasonable value from the marketplace. What an insurance company pays in a collateral source situation for those persons who are insured with health insurance is irrelevant. That's common law in Colorado going back to Carr v. Boyd. That's the codification of the collateral source doctrine. And what the collateral source doctrine was is none of this came in. I mean, evidence could come in of the amount.
What's the evidence on the flip side? I'm not really challenging that as much as asking the other side. So what's the evidence that, given our reasoning there, that the amount billed is always some evidence of the reasonable market value? I mean, if you could think of hypotheticals. If you had a bill and at the same time you said, but there's a 50% discount 365 days a year for everybody, well, then clearly that wouldn't really be what was being billed.
That evidence ought to come in. I mean, if, for example, and we run into this. So we call the physical therapists, particularly. We call them a lot and just say, look, do you have, because of medical payments coverages now on automobile policies, and we know we've got a pool of $5,000 and we'd like to maximize it. Do you have a rate which you bill insurance, and do you have a rate for which you will allow cash-paying customers? Yes, we will allow a 10%, 5%, 15% discount for cash-paying customers. Will you bill our client on a cash payment basis? Yes. The value of the amount billed is one evidence, but since they're willing to accept a cash discount, that's the amount which was paid. It's being paid for by cash. So what I'm saying is there are factors where that can come in. The incongruity of all of this is that when we start in a health insurance situation and we start allowing the amounts paid, that's where we run into the problem. It runs afoul of the common law. It runs afoul of 13-21-111.6, and it now runs afoul of 10-1-135-10A. The beauty of all three of those is we finally have a nice umbrella where everything is uniform. We finally have got it right now in Colorado. We've got the common law consistent with the codification, and we now have a statute that says This is what we really mean.
Since you're on that statute, sure. And I appreciate your argument doing this, your time is limited, and you're sort of the author, at least from my reading, of the primary arguments about the applicability of
yes.
135 and what it means.
Yes.
Could you address certainly. 135?
Yeah. Let's talk about
it. And particularly maybe that applicability clause, which nobody else has discussed, and I know you... Yeah. You have a theory about why that makes sense.
Oh, I do have a theory. At least I hope I have a theory. Let's see if it's
you wouldn't have happened to have drafted this bill, would you?
I did not, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, I was here arguing Smith v. Jebson with you a year ago and didn't even know that it was on the books and the governor was going to sign it 2 days later, and then kind of had egg on my face going, oh, my God, we just said things to the court that, you know, aren't quite there. Well, first of all, this idea about one title, one subject. Let's look at what the title says. Concerning a limitation on the ability of an insurer to obtain re-benefits from an injured party who recovers damages. So that's a litigant in an automobile case or any other type of case, Walmart case, suing for damages against a tortfeasor or an uninsured or underinsured motorist, which is mentioned in 10-1-135-10A, recovers damages from the party responsible for the injury in situations when the injured party would not be fully compensated. Fully compensated raises questions of billed, paid, reasonable value of medical services, if the benefits are repaid to the insurer. That's the title. So then let's look at the case law in Colorado that talks about single subject, Parrish v. Lamb, which I cite, which is a 1988 case. As to the single subject requirement, this court said, so long as the matters encompassed in the bill are necessarily or properly connected to each other rather than disconnected or incongruous, the single subject requirement of Section 21 is not violated. And I submit that it's not violated, and I'm going to explain how this works in operation. But there's also two components to the single subject rule. There's not only the single subject rule, but there's also the clear expression requirement. And what this court said in Parrish was, for purposes of passing constitutional scrutiny under the clear expression requirement of Section 21, particularity in the titling of bills, it is neither necessary nor desirable. Generality is commendable if the legislation is germane to the general subject expressed in the title. If it is relevant and appropriate to such subject matter, it does not violate the clear expression requirement of Section 21 of Article 5 of the Constitution. So, my argument is, having just gone through the reading that I just went through, there is a relationship, and here's where the relationship comes in. I've heard double dipping, single dipping, windfalls. There is no windfall. Here's the reality of what happened in Walmart. Here's the reality of what happened in Sunahara. And here's the reality of how this statute plays in. If there is health insurance, there are rights of subrogation. And so even though the plaintiff may recover an amount of medical bills paid or some reasonable value of the medical services, the plaintiff receives those sums and the health insurer is sitting right there waiting for subrogation reimbursement. There's no windfall. There's an actual conduit of money, and we end up being the collection agent. I say we, my clients and myself, for United Healthcare, for Cigna, for Nginx, and for all the companies who handle those. So the reason that this is all under one aegis of this statute is that, yes, this talks about subrogation. This talks about what health insurers can get in a situation in which there has been a recovery. But in order to avoid a situation where not only has there been one reduction by the jury, i.e., they know the amount was paid, so they only awarded the amount paid, there's been a second reduction by the trial court per the contract exception to 13-121-111-6, and all of a sudden we're left with zero. Trust me, I've been there. Just because they got $100,000 awarded in damages, United Healthcare could care less whether it was medical expense, wage loss, or non-economic damages. United Healthcare is still sitting there with We have our subrogation amount, and if it's ERISA, it's like, forget it. We want 100%. We're the feds. Federal law controls. You don't have any right to negotiate. That's why this bill came into existence, 10-1-135, is to try. You can't overcome ERISA. We're not even going to try and overcome ERISA. But it tried to put some sense to how do litigants go to court, try to put on their case, recover reasonable damages, get reasonable damages, and then still satisfy the subrogation claim that they have to with their health insurance carrier. It is all in one ball. It all comes together very, very nicely. And the legislature has spoken, and I think it fits beautifully. You've now got this great combination of Crossgrove, the court in Crossgrove, doing a tremendous job of chronicling the history of the common law, the decisional law in Colorado, and showing how that absolutely dovetails with the codification of 13-21-111.6. And now we have this absolute perfect in-post bookend of 10-1-135-10A that helps bring it all together.
I ask you one specific question.
Absolutely.
Right at the end about 135 and you. With regard to your particular case, would you explain to us again how you construe this effective date clause to include your case?
Oh, absolutely. It's very simple. It's in my brief, and I've got a lot of case law, and I've got a lot of examples, but it all hinges on, you've got to read Judge Pratt's order. I mean, Judge Pratt, this is the order that's before the court. It was entered January 19, 2011, and as Judge Pratt so eloquently stated, recovery. The statute says recovery. For all recovery after August 11, 2010, there's been no recovery in this case. 10-1-135 is applicable to this case if and when we get back.
And so that interpretation means, I have a little trouble following that and understanding it, but basically then what your argument is when it says it's applicable to recoveries after this date, that means anything where there might be a recovery after this date, even though there hasn't been a recovery yet.
Well, it goes back to the simple argument of when is a judgment final? And Crossgrove is not final yet. I mean, it's on appeal. So this thing's going to either get affirmed on appeal, reversed on appeal. So there has been no recovery of a judgment or a settlement in Walmart. There's been no recovery.
What about your case? You haven't gone to a jury yet.
We haven't even gone to a jury yet.
And yet it applies to your case because you might get a recovery sometime in the future?
Correct.
Okay.
That's what the statute says. That's what the legislature said. It applies.
If we had, say, a statute of limitations, and it said this applies to, this is a statute of limitations that applies to convictions within a certain number of years after the conviction, and it's clearly intended to be a statute of limitations applying to post-conviction relief. But wouldn't the logic of your case seem to say, well, then, no, we think that we could interpret the statute to be a statute of limitations to the case itself because sometime in the future there will be a judgment, and therefore that statute can apply to our case.
And since I'm out of time, I'm going to direct you to my brief, and it's the cases that talk about procedural and remedial measures, and they are, in effect, then prospective. I'm out of time, I take it, Mr. Chief Justice.
To the question.
Pardon?
You.
Oh, okay. I didn't. I felt
not for 10 minutes.
Not for 10 minutes. You know me, huh?
I wasn't trying to lead you astray to violate our rules.
No, what I'm basically saying is in a criminal context, I've got cases in the brief. In a civil context, it's a question of whether or not what has been enacted by the legislature is procedural and remedial in nature, and I maintain that this is what we have in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Tuck.
Thank you very much. I hope I didn't overstay my stay, Mr. Chief Justice.
Good morning, Your Honors. So may it please the Court. My name is Tom Seaman. My client is State Farm. State Farm was allowed to intervene in the Smith versus Jepson case. And I see I got a little less than 3 minutes in rebuttal here. The first thing I want to say is that from State Farm's perspective, there's a broad sweeping effect of any rule of evidence that makes it per se inadmissible to admit any evidence with regard to amounts that are paid. And the reason that it goes, it's such a broad sweeping effect to State Farm is that we're not just talking about claims that are in litigation, because most of the claims that State Farm handles or that any insurance company handles are not litigated. Probably better than 90% of them are settled without litigation. But it goes to the valuation of those claims, because State Farm is charged with the obligation to investigate and evaluate and try to resolve those claims. And what they are now hearing from the attorneys that are representing claimants, whether they're first-party claimants or insureds bringing first-party claims or third-party claimants, is that the only evidence that is going to be admissible at trial will be the amount that's billed, so that the claim ought to be therefore evaluated. The medical expense component of the claim can only be evaluated based upon one number, and that number is the amount that was billed by the medical provider. And so it grossly inflates the value of these claims in terms of what insurers and third-party claimants.
Well, that's not actually what we heard about, you know, what the law really is. The law is a reasonable value of the services, right?
Well, except that, I agree with you, Your Honor, except that when you take out of the equation the ability to introduce evidence of what was actually paid, and you allow introduction of evidence of what was billed as a practical matter, and I think the plaintiff's attorneys understand and recognize this, and that's why they're arguing it. As a practical matter, what the plaintiff's attorneys are counting on is if the case goes to trial under that per se evidentiary rule, and the only evidence that the jury has to consider is the amount that was billed, that's what they're going to conclude.
Second, I mean, whenever you evaluate a claim, or whatever the statutes are, before instruction and interpretation, whatever the statute is. So the lawyers are just doing what they're supposed to be doing, and you're going to have to evaluate it based on the statutory construct. So what's your position? That you have to pay more money because the statute requires it? I don't get it.
Our position is that the evidentiary rule ought to allow evidence of amount paid as well as amount billed and allow the jury to do what the jury
is. Oh, okay. That's something you'd like to do. Talk to the legislature. But what about the statute?
We're talking about 10-1-135. I agree with the comments that have been made by Heather Selig and by Mr. Patterson. I think it violates the single subject rule. I also, you asked earlier whether it violated due process. I definitely think it does, because it or the way that it adopts this per se rule that is applied across the board and excludes relevant evidence of what was actually paid, which I think, you know, is a better measure in terms of what those damages actually are. Thank you, Your Honor.
Second. Okay. Yes. You have a question. Anybody have any other questions? Is there anything you want to say? Interrupted you some.
The one thing I was going to answer is one of Mr. Thompson's questions, that is what happens to the uninsured individual who has to pay those bills himself because he doesn't have insurance. If the evidence of amount paid is admissible and considered relevant, my answer to that is that the uninsured individual who pays, assuming they do pay the full billed amount, recovers those as damages, because that is, in fact, what those damages are. But I think you allow that by allowing evidence of what's paid. We're not suggesting that an uninsured individual who pays the entire amount of the bill ought to be compensated at some lesser amount. But why shouldn't the jury have that evidence to consider? I also agree with Ms. Salk that, and I would commend to you, and I'm sure you've already looked at it, the Copic instruction, I think, given to the jury allows them to hear that evidence and then apply it in a reasonable fashion and come up with a result. And I don't agree with the 403 analysis that this is going to be prejudicial to plaintiffs if they get that type of instruction. Thank you.
Thank you. Arguments will be submitted on the briefs. Also, I want to thank the.